Gene was just telling me that he had some Jehovah's Witnesses come by, and he said he told them everything that he'd learned in class, and they denied all of it. Oh, that was funny. He asked him about the J manuscripts, and they said, J manuscripts? J manuscripts. Well, what about all the predictions? Predictions? What predictions? Poor Gene, he wonders. He wonders if he's really in the right Bible college now. Oh, it's incredible. The things that we will face with all of this knowledge on cults will amaze us. Boy, pretty amazing. Okay, the next source in the Book of Mormon is there was one main article in the Wayne Sentinel, one main newspaper article on August 31st, 1827. And this was an article about a man named Jesse Strang. Now, this is not Mr. Strang of the Strangites, of one of those splinter Mormon churches. It's an entirely different man. Now, this man is shown to have committed certain crimes, and then they hung him, and it says that he suffered a painful and ignominious death, and so a very disgraceful death, very painful, and so that's how it's described. And so in Alma 1, verse 15, Nehor, or Nahor, N-E-H-O-R, he is the same man. And he did the same crimes, and he was before the judges in the same way, and he died the same way by hanging. And it says that he suffered a painful and disgraceful, ignominious death. So there we go. There's another copying of something just from the newspaper. Now, another one, this is known as the Solomon Spaulding theory. The Solomon Spaulding theory, S-P-A-U-L-D-I-N-G, Solomon Spaulding. And for more information, you can look in Kingdom of the Cults, pages 168 to 170. Now, the Tanners don't agree with this, and I don't know why, they just don't. But Walter Martin thinks that it's a good possibility. Now, this involves a book written by Spalding. And this was a novel entitled Manuscript Story. Manuscript Story. And it's a story about an ancient manuscript that was found. Now, Solomon Spalding was a highly educated man. And he wrote of things in clever ways. And those that were intelligent like he was would pick up what he was really saying. And he was presenting more or less a spoof. And he was using certain words that people that understood the meaning and the usage of the words at that time, they would enjoy this. They'd find it to be humorous. And he wrote of a prophet named Mormon. And he did it humorously, knowing that knowledgeable readers would find the name very funny. Now, Joseph Smith was an ignorant man. It's proven by the 12,000 mistakes in the Book of Mormon, about 8,000 of which involve spelling and punctuation and things like that. And the theory is, the possibility is, he copied the name. And so he took this idea of finding a manuscript. So he's got the book, he's got the plates. See, that's where he's, this is all part of his story as well, of course. See, Joseph Smith's story. And he's got this prophet, Mormon. And he just copies the name right into his book. And he doesn't know the real implications. Now, what Joseph Smith didn't know, and what Mormons today don't know, and this wasn't in Webster's Dictionary, so I don't know the real validity of this and where you'd have to look this up to confirm it and all of that. But according to the story from Walter Martin, and according to this thing going back to Solomon Spalding, is that the word Mormon is a species of baboon. And so that is where the humor of the whole thing is. And since Smith was ignorant and didn't know anything about such things, he wrote about Prophet Mormon. And Mormons don't know that today, and I don't know whether it's really true or not. And maybe that's part of the reason the Tanners disagree. Maybe it's too hard to prove or to support or whatever. Yeah. I don't know that either. I would assume Walter Martin would give you that. But it would be prior to Joseph Smith writing the Book of Mormon. Maybe right close to that time. But 18th century. But oh, so, okay. Okay, good. Thank you. So in the 1700s. Okay. And so maybe that used to be... And it's a very good possibility. If you're going all the way back that far in time, and today with Mormon meaning the member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the term Mormon would no longer mean a species of a baboon. It would no longer mean that. And you wouldn't find that in present-day dictionaries. Because Mormon's looking up the word Mormon and seeing members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Mormon... You know, meaning number one, meaning number two, species of baboon might be suing these publishing companies. So that would be a very good possibility as to why the meaning really doesn't exist anymore. And see, again, that's the way languages are. Meanings of words change by usage. The usage of the word determines the meaning. It's not, we don't go back to a dictionary of 1800s or something, if there were really any such thing as actual dictionaries or any sort of a book that would define the meaning of words and make our definition of words based on that. We don't. We go according to how the words are used today. You can compare early editions of Webster's Dictionary with present day ones, and the meanings are vastly different with many, many, many of the words. You'll find some of the meanings are no longer listed at all, because the words simply do not mean that any longer in our society. So that's another source. And then the last one is the Westminster Confession of Faith. The Westminster Confession of Faith. And this is the Presbyterian Catechism that was printed in 1729. And Alma, chapter 40, is a verbatim plagiarism of, I think it's of chapter 30 of this catechism. And so he must have had a Westminster Confession of Faith picked up, maybe a used bookstore or something, or by the side of the road one day, and flipped through it and put it in there. I mean, trying to figure out what was going through this man's mind. He's like the preacher out on the golf course who's getting his sermons by where the ball lands and by if it goes in the water hazard. And I mean, that's kind of where the Book of Mormon is coming from. He's just walking down his path of life, and he's just picking things up and putting it in and just telling this wild story. That's what the Book of Mormon is. It's a wild, fictitious story. So that's a pretty amazing thing. Now, in looking carefully at the Book of Mormon, it's really clear that he had a copy of the King James Bible in front of him. He had to. Like I mentioned, there's 25,000 words from it. And in Old Testament times, see, the Book of Mormon, the vast, large portions of it, I don't know if you could really say the vast majority, but large portions of it are Old Testament times. And you find repeated salvation phrases and New Testament terminology that had not been revealed unto any of the prophets. Things that were going to come in the New Testament times are recorded in the Old Testament historical parts of the Book of Mormon. Things that would be, so you're dealing with 2250 BC and the time period around there, and then you're dealing much more so with from 600 BC to AD 400. And a good portion of that is prior to Christ, prior to the AD 34. And in all of these different sections that are clearly Old Testament times, you've got New Testament statements, statements about salvation, some pretty amazing ones. And all of these are in the Old Testament portion of the Book of Mormon. It mentions the shed blood of Christ. And you don't find that from Genesis to Malachi. You don't find a statement, the shed blood of Christ. You can find it. Never said. But in the Old Testament portion of the Book of Mormon, it's found. The atonement through Christ. The phrase, plan of salvation. Come unto Christ for rest. Filled with Holy Spirit. Now we know that there is a anointing of God's Spirit and a certain indwelling of God's Spirit upon priests and prophets, judges, kings, and other such people in the Old Testament. But you don't find this term used in this way in the Old Testament. Resurrection of Christ. Baptism in Holy Ghost, fire, and water. That's not in the Old Testament. It uses the name of Jesus Christ. The Holy Child Jesus, Son of the Father. That's again Old Testament, but that's New Testament terminology. You have the statement, New Jerusalem and its type. You want to know where that one is? That's in Ether 13:6. Remember who Ether was? He was the one person remaining after all the Jaredites killed one another. He's the one who left to record the history. So that's back 2200 BC, 2000 BC, 2100 BC. That's back there a long time. 2,000 years before Christ. And we're talking about the New Jerusalem and its type. This cannot be. And also use the term apostles, also in the Book of Ether. You know, all these terms. They just show somebody using the King James right there in front of them. I had to be doing that. We mentioned the anachronisms. Have glass and steel and a compass. And then there's also a number of instances where God did not agree with himself in the Book of Mormon. And if indeed it is supposed that he had anything to do with the inspiration of the Book of Mormon, Pearl of Great Price, Doctrine and Covenants, or the other recorded utterances of Joseph Smith, because in the Book of Mormon, in 3 Nephi 12:2, and in Moroni 8:11, 3 Nephi 12:2, Moroni 8:11, the remission of sins is the result of baptism. That's what Acts 2:38 says. So that sounds like we're doing okay. See, remission of sins is the result. See, you're repent and be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of sins. So that shows the result of water baptism is the remission of sins. And it says, yea, blessed are they who shall be baptized, for they shall receive the remission of their sin. Behold, baptism is unto repentance, to the fulfilling of the commandments, unto the remission of sin. But the book of Doctrine and Covenants, chapter 20, or section 20, verse 37, it says, all who humble themselves and truly manifest by their works that they have received the Spirit of Christ unto the remission of their sins shall be received by baptism into his church. Now that turns the whole thing around. There in the Book of Mormon, it's putting remission of sins after baptism. Doctrine and Covenants is demanding it before baptism. Entirely the opposite. Totally the opposite. Complete, total contradiction. Now, there's also the question of some false prophecies. And Joseph Smith drew heavily upon published articles, both in newspapers and in magazines. In fact, one of his famous prophecies concerning the Civil War is drawn chiefly from material published in New York State at the time. Smith declared in Doctrine and Covenants, section 87. So this deals with Smith as being a prophet. Section 87. At the rebellion of South Carolina, the southern states would call on other nations, even the nation of Great Britain, and then war shall be poured out upon all nations, and slaves shall rise up against their masters. And the remnant shall vex the Gentiles with a sword of fixation, whatever that is. Now, the Civil War did break out some years after Smith's death. Remember, he died in 1844, but still 20-some years off. Maybe not quite 20, but in that vicinity. And England did not become involved in the Civil War. And all the nations were not involved. And the slaves did not rise up against their masters. And the remnants, you could say, who were the Indians, were themselves vexed by the Gentiles, being defeated in war and confined to reservations. So it didn't turn around. See, the Gentiles are the non-Jewish people. Well, that means if somebody's going to vex the Gentiles, it has to be Jewish people. Well, the only Jewish people there are the Indians. Remember, they're the lineage. They're of Israel. They're Jews. But what happened to them after the Civil War? What happened to them during the Wild West? They ended up being defeated and put on reservations. They didn't end up vexing the Gentiles. They were vexed by the Gentiles. So none of it came to pass. So here's a big prophecy. None of it happened, except for the Civil War part. And then all the other details, though, didn't. And you can read enough things, and if you watch enough things for long enough time, you can make predictions, and you can get 1 out of 10 right. It's not that hard to predict things. You're like saying, well, I think there'll be more war in the Middle East. Well, what does that make me? It means I must know something that's going on in the world. It's pretty obvious. Now, there's going to be more racial conflicts in the United States. Well, so... But then when you get down to the details of it, and you say England's going to be involved, the nations are going to be involved, and all the rest, then we find out who's a prophet. And when you get down to the details, we find out Joseph Smith clearly was not a prophet. Now, also, in Doctrine and Covenants, he prophesied that he would possess the house he built at Nauvoo forever and ever. Section 124, verses 22, 23, and 59. Now, the fact of the matter is that neither Joseph nor his seed after him lived from generation to generation in Nauvoo. They didn't. It was destroyed after Smith's death, and the Mormons moved on to Utah. And we don't have any time gap theology here either. So don't be saying, what about time gaps in prophecy? It's not going to work. So it's just an example that these prophecies were not coming to pass. He also had prophesied the restoration of Israel to Palestine. And it shows that he anticipated the millennium in his own time. But they did not get back to Palestine when he said they would. They didn't get back until after 100 years after his death. He was not a prophet of God. He was a false prophet. I want to make just a few comments on Doctrine and Covenants and Pearl of Great Price. I don't want to say too much about them. Now, the Book of Mormon is what appears by their statements to be, like I said, this is the fullness of the gospel, but in actuality it's not. Now, concerning Doctrine and Covenants, this volume, which was first published in 1876, contains 136 sections or chapters, and each of those are divided into verses. I don't think it was first published in 1876. I think in the form that it has now. I think it was published in other forms previously. I don't have a date on that, though. And I would assume that some of the sections were published during the lifetime of Joseph Smith. But in the form that it has now, with chapters and verses, that form came in 1876. And these are all revelations given through Joseph Smith, except for section 136, which was a revelation given through Brigham Young after he had become the president. And also the current version, the version that we have today, includes what is known as the Manifesto, which is the statement prohibiting polygamy. It doesn't repudiate it. It doesn't reject it. It just, for the time being, prohibits it. And this was written by President Wilford Woodruff. And he was president 1890. Wilford Woodruff. So, in actuality, Doctrine and Covenants today consists of things from three people: Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and Wilford Woodruff, although the vast majority of it is from Joseph Smith. Now, these revelations deal with such doctrines as the nature of God, the church, the priesthood, the millennium, the resurrection, the state of man after death, the various grades of salvation, and the list just goes on and on and on. It's the book that has their doctrine. It has their teaching. Now, many of these revelations were addressed to specific persons and deal with very specific matters. And this is another thing that shows really the non-inspiration of the Book of Mormon. Section 19 is addressed to Martin Harris, and it instructs him to pay the debt that he has contracted with a printer. Now, Martin, pay the debt. Can you? It just doesn't sound like the Word of God, does it? Somehow it isn't. I haven't seen things quite like that in the Psalms and Ezekiel and other places. There's just something kind of peculiar about it. In section 104, a revelation is given concerning the disposition of certain lots and houses in Kirtland, Ohio. along with the individuals to whom these properties are assigned. Sounds like Joseph Smith just wanted to put a portion of his will into the Doctrine and Covenants. And then section 132 is the section on polygamy, which is rejected by the Reformed Church, the Reorganized Church. That was the word I was looking for. Wondered if I'd ever find it. Finally did. And they reject that, say Joseph Smith didn't write it. And there's even a section in there where it's addressed directly to his wife and says if she doesn't accept it, she's going to be destroyed. Actually names her. That would be kind of amazing. I'm glad my wife's name's not in there. It's not the kind of memorial that was in preserving Mary and her shows of love for Christ. It's just not quite the same kind of memorial. It just comes across a little bit different. The particular significance of Doctrine and Covenants for present-day Mormonism is that it contains revelations about baptism for the dead, and that's in sections 124, 127, and 128. It also gives information on celestial marriage. That's also in section 132. And so those things are very, very important. See, the Book of Mormon doesn't deal with baptism for the dead or celestial marriage. And the incredible thing, as I mentioned before, it even condemns and denounces polygamy. That's in Jacob chapter 2, verses 24 and 27. So it condemns it, denounces it. Now the other book is The Pearl of Great Price. And it's a small volume, and it contains the Book of Moses, which is 8 chapters covering the same general period as that covered by the first 6 chapters of Genesis. So there's a Book of Moses, 8 chapters. It's more or less a parallel to the first 6 chapters of Genesis. This book, as was previously indicated, is a copy of the opening chapters of Smith's inspired version. So what he's done here is the first part of the Pearl of Great Price is the beginning of the inspired version, which Joseph Smith was never able to complete. And so that's what we have. This gives you an idea of what the inspired version would have been like if it had ever been completed. And I'll tell you all he did. He sat down with a King James, and he opened it up, and he started writing. And where he didn't like what it was saying, he just put in his own words. He said it the way he wanted to say it, and that's all it is. That's the inspired version. Now, there may be some demonic inspiration in it, but I don't think that's really all that necessary. I'm sure there is, but I don't think he came under some sort of a spirit. He may have, but this is just part of his whole scheme. I really don't know what was motivating him, really. Now, with the polygamy, I think it's pretty obvious what was motivating him there. And he must have still had somewhat of a conscience, because he didn't want to just enter into out-and-out adultery. He wanted to have more of a nice facade and kind of put it more in kind of an acceptable and legal framework. But it kind of shows what his heart was. And maybe in this whole thing, there's pride, and he wants to be elevated and be important. And somebody who's out digging all of his life for treasure and looking at a peepstone and probably has been degraded and despised, mistreated. When somebody can go to Palmyra, New York, and write out a statement signed by 62 people telling that the whole Smith family, they were shady characters, they were not reputable, they weren't reliable, you can tell that he wasn't real well accepted in his community. So then there can be the natural inclination that he's going to try to establish something where he's acceptable. So he becomes something. And you find this so often. You see where people are today, it's a reaction to where they used to be and what they used to be in and how the devil had them here, and now they're over here because they've gone from one ditch to another. One wasn't so much of their own making, more being a product of their environment, a product of their parents, and now they react and they exercise their will, but they don't have any idea how to really exercise their will and any way to really find acceptance and security, and so now they're over here. And that's what you see with Madeline Marie O'Hare. You see that exact thing with her and with many, many others like her. It's a sad and tragic story to see what has happened to people, and you can trace these things. You can really see it's not just some coincidence that they ended up over here. There's all sorts of factors that cause them to make decisions, and through those decisions, this is where they are. And some is where they had blame and bitterness towards God. He may have been in a situation where he couldn't find any minister that would help him. He may have tried to get some help from somebody, and maybe because there weren't any ministers with the heart of God and the love of God, he may have more or less wrote them off and said, well, then I'll make my own religion. People have made decisions just like that, and they never even knew that demons were really working behind the whole thing. Some people that are they're very deceived, but they have no idea that it's demons that have motivated them. They really know nothing about demons. They don't really know anything about voices. They don't know anything about people coming to them, visions or anything else. But they just say, well, then I'm going to do this. And they just start using what they think is their own imagination. Joseph Smith may have done that very same thing. Now, you know demons are in it, but that doesn't always mean the people are aware of it. See, I don't think Joseph Smith really had to have any sort of relationship with demonic spirits knowingly to put together what happened here. And I don't think he had to have any sort of visitation from heaven by demons, masquerading as angels of light for him to put this thing together. I don't think he really needed that. Looks like to me that with his imagination and his talent to tell stories and maybe trying to find security and prestige and respect, that he could come up with this. It's what a con artist does, puts together these wild schemes, and they work, and he ends up being in this hotel in the penthouse for 2 weeks and not paying the bill there and over here and getting this car and this person's money. And it's amazing the kind of lives some of these people were able to live. Now, I'm not saying that there wasn't demons. I'm not saying he didn't have any experiences. I don't really know. But I wouldn't read all of that into it. I wouldn't say, now, he had a demon. An actual demon named Moroni came. And this is what exactly happened. And it didn't really have to be that way. And you can get other people to be in cahoots with you. You can get all over Cowdery in this thing. Say, well, Oliver, I'm going to write it up like this. But I think this will work. What do you think? And I'll say, I baptize you and you baptize me. And well, let's have John the Baptist come. I mean, that's what they do when writers get together to put together a script for a TV show and other things. They just get together and they start spinning yarns and writing down ideas. That could have happened. No, I mean, it's a possibility. Those are just things to think about. Now, the second thing in the Pearl of Great Price is the Book of Abraham. Now, the Book of Abraham is supposedly a translation from an Egyptian papyrus. So now we've got this Egyptian papyrus. And I don't remember the exact story of where he supposedly found it. I think he was at a carnival, and they had these mummy cases. And he said, and he bought them, and he opened one of the mummy cases, and here was this Abraham's papyrus. And that's where this came from. Yeah, that's quite a story, isn't it? And this document represents the latter stage in Smith's theological development because it's filled with polytheism. Every time it mentions God, it's gods. It's always plural. And this shows really what Mormonism is. And it's what it is. It's a rewriting of the first chapter of Genesis in a polytheistic fashion. It says, and they, the gods, said, let there be light. And it has the gods in council. It's all the gods. Every single thing is gods. I read just a little teeny bit of it. I was looking at it last week. I thought, this is very interesting. I didn't know that it was written like this. Abraham is got five chapters, and in chapter 4 it begins and it says, "And the Lord said, let us go down, and they went down at the beginning, and they," that is the gods, "organized and formed the heavens and the earth. And then the spirit of the gods was brooding upon the face of the waters. And they," the gods, "said, and they," the gods, "comprehended the light. And the gods called the light day. And the gods also said, let there be an expanse. And the gods said, let us prepare earth. And the gods watched those things which they had ordered." And verse 26, which is Genesis 1:26, "And the gods took counsel among themselves and said, let us go down and form man in our image after our likeness, and we will give them dominion over the fish of the sea. So the gods went down to organize man in their own image, in the image of the gods to form they him, male and female, to form they them. And the gods said, we will bless them." And it goes on that same way through chapter 5. So those two chapters in the book of Abraham are polytheism. And so that's why it's said here to be more of his final theological developments. And he's just moving into clear, absolute polytheism. Now, this book supposedly was written by Abraham while he was in Egypt. And it tells about the star Kolob. Star Kolob is kind of an interesting thing in the theology of Mormons. K-O-L-O-B. Which is said to be the greatest of all the stars and the one nearest to God. Kolob is the largest star and the one nearest to God. And as I recall, it's even where the gods have come from and where some of the spirit beings have been produced. And so Kolob is very significant. Sounds like the name of a new popsicle or something. You may have walked by a store and there's this name on a book by Harry Kolob, and there's a new word. I wonder where he got some of these words. There's some very interesting words. It also talks about the preexistence of souls and the plan to prepare an earth for these souls and the plan to subject these souls to a period of probation on earth and about the organization of matter whereby the heavens and the earth were formed. And then there's also an extract from Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible, and it's chapter 24 of Matthew. So we have the book of Moses and the book of Abraham, and then an extract from Joseph Smith's translation of Matthew 24. And then we have extracts from the history of Joseph the prophet. And these narrate the discovery of the plates and the translation of them. So that's also here in the Pearl of Great Price. And then the last thing in the Pearl of Great Price are the Articles of Faith. The Articles of Faith. And then there's just the one last thing, as far as what they're basing their theology on, is the fact that they can have modern-day revelation that comes through the church hierarchy. And so here's another example of extra-biblical authority. And as I mentioned before, the presidents of the church are in a place where they can write just like Joseph Smith or Brigham Young. And that would be the reason why the manifesto by Woodruff is in the Pearl of Great Price, or at the very end of this, at the end of Doctrine and Covenants. That's why that would be there. Showing here's the president, and he was writing something from God, and it had full inspiration. And so that would... See, there's still that open door for more inspiration, more revelation. And so that's been left open. And that's to be expected in cults. It's always to be expected in them. Well, that takes care of that. Now we want to talk about Mormon doctrine. So Mormon doctrine. Won't get very far tonight, but... Yeah?
I was just thinking the fact that this is a perfect translation from God, but it has chapters and verses in it, whereas the original didn't have chapters and verses, 19th century later.
Well, God was just helping them out, you know. He just it's a lot of work to figure out the chapters and the verses. And you know, none of it makes any sense. None of it. I can't imagine God saying chapter 1, verse 1. verse 2, verse 3. Now we're going to chapter 2. That's verse 1, verse 2. And it really doesn't make any sense. And then for it all to be coming from God, and capitalization's wrong, punctuation's wrong, spelling's wrong. Unfortunately, it looks more like some of the papers handed in Bible college. I mean, you know, it shows a man who was not out there studying English in some college. I'm sure Joseph Smith did not really spend a lot of time in school. It does not strike me as a man who was highly educated, and he could care less about English and other such things. And so it comes right through. It comes right through into the Book of Mormon. But if Mormons today saw the 1830 edition, they'd be embarrassed. So they've had to change it. And to go through and make 12,000 changes, that means you've done a lot of work in this book. So they've revised and revised and changed and changed. And they're trying to get away from any embarrassment. That's what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. But they can't get away from them.
As far as you know, do most Mormons today have those three books?
I would assume all of them do. They're the three books for Mormons. And so I would assume they all do. I can't imagine that they wouldn't, but...
Mormons come to a house and witness, they will give you, after about the second or third meeting with you, a Book of Mormon.
Mm.
And they say, this book has been donated by such and such family, and how it is yours to use.
Mm. Another example of good works. It's part of what's that. See, donated by this family. And so here's this family that they have spent the $3, $4, $5, whatever it costs, and they're willing to give you this book. And see, there's that thing of trying to win one person, befriend some person. So, okay. Now, Mormons base their doctrine not upon the Bible and not upon the Book of Mormon. It comes primarily Doctrine and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price. And primarily of those two, Doctrine and Covenants. Now, their theology is not a system of denial like the Jehovah's Witnesses. Remember, we talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't believe this, they don't believe this, they don't believe this, they don't believe this. Well, that's not the way Mormons are. And it isn't a modification of Christian doctrine either. So it's not denial. Excuse me, it's not modification. But it's a system which has itself originated entirely new, unique doctrines, new sets of doctrines, ones which have only extra-biblical authority. See, they're not going through the Bible and denying things, and they're not going through the Bible and really modifying things. They're not in the Bible. They don't have anything to do in the Bible, really. They have originated entirely new sets of unique doctrines. That's what they've done. And it's all based on their extra-biblical authority. So this is a kind of a unique thing. It's quite a bit different from the other cults. Now, the first doctrine we'll talk about is polygamy. And this is plural marriage. And it was established as a result of a direct revelation. And it says, was established as a result of direct revelation, and many of those who followed the same felt they were divinely commanded to do so. So showing God leading, God directing. And it's found in Doctrine and Covenants, section 132. And we'll read through some of that in a little bit. And it has been noted that the gods of Mormonism are polygamous. They're into polygamy. And these gods of Mormonism are constantly begetting children. The second president of Brigham Young said, when our father Adam came into the Garden of Eden, he brought Eve, one of his wives, with him. Now, they've changed their position on Adam, and they don't hold that Adam is God as they used to. But Brigham Young did, and this is where it came from. That the God of this earth here was Adam, and he brought one of his wives with him from someplace like Kolob, and came here and started really bringing forth children. That's the kind of teaching they have. And thus it is the concept that Jesus Christ was married and Jesus Christ was a polygamist. So Jesus Christ was married and had more than one wife. And see, only by begetting children could he attain unto the utmost in the celestial kingdom. If he wasn't married, he can't be begetting children, and he really can't have a kingdom. And he can't really be a God. So he had to be married. Mormon theology demands that Jesus Christ is married in this life. You've got to get married here. There's no other place to get married. You don't get married up there. And you've got to be married here first, evidently. You can have people who have died and marry them now. People that are dead, you can be living here, and a woman can marry a man who's already died. And do it just in a... You just go through a celestial ceremony, marriage ceremony, and you can marry him. And so there are a lot of people that have been marrying Joseph Smith. And he probably has upwards of 20,000 wives by now, if not more. But you had to be married here. Evidently, you had to be married here first, or you couldn't do that. Because if you could go through this life and not be married, and then just marry people that are here through this kind of a ceremony, you're already dead and gone, but people can marry you and then be joined to you when they die, then there wouldn't have to be this kind of doctrine. Because Jesus Christ then wouldn't have to be married here. He could have people marrying him now, and they'd be joining him when they die here in this life. But evidently, you have to be married here before you can do that. So he had to be married. Now, polygamy has become a controversial issue because it's now outlawed by law. It's against the law. And so it's caused its problems. Joseph Fielding Smith, who is the sixth president of the church, wrote, "I can positively state on indisputable evidence that Joseph Smith was the author under God of the revelation on plural marriage." So he was the author. And he cites an affidavit concerning one plural wife of Joseph Smith, and he also gives the names of six other women who testified under oath that they were sealed during his lifetime to the prophet Joseph Smith. So he was a polygamist. Joseph Smith was. Now, see, the reorganized church says that he wasn't. And they say that he didn't write DNC 132 either, but he did both. He was a polygamist, and he did write that. And the reorganized church is wrong. Now, polygamy continued as a church observance in Utah for 10 years without any law being enacted in opposition to it. But beginning in 1862, there started to be federal statutes, and they declared this thing unlawful. And then there were many appeals by the church to the government, and they were unsuccessful. And finally, President Wilford Woodruff, the only man on earth holding the keys of sealing ordinances, issued an official declaration in 1890. Thereupon, the church discontinued the practice of plural marriage, according to James E. Talmadge, one of the 12 apostles of the Mormon Church. Now, here's a few quotes. "Jesus Christ was a polygamist. Mary and Martha, the sisters of Lazarus, were his plural wives, and Mary Magdalene was another. Also, the bridal feast of Cana of Galilee, where Jesus turned water into wine, was on the occasion of one of his own marriages." That was stated by Brigham Young. Another quote, "We say it was Jesus Christ who was married at Cana to Mary and Martha, whereby he could see his own seed before he was crucified." They say the reference is to Isaiah 53:10. So they even bring in the Bible there. That was from Orson Hyde. And then one last quote, "A belief in the doctrine of the plurality of wives caused the persecution of Jesus and his followers." That's why they were persecuted, because they believed in polygamy. And the Jews of the day were not able to accept the revelation. That's pretty far-fetched. Now,
Paul married
too? Paul?
Yeah.
No, we know Paul wasn't married. I don't know what they say. I don't know. Call him up on the phone and ask him. Tell me what they say. When you see two of those guys riding down the street on their bicycle in their blue suits, wave them over and ask them if Paul was married. I really don't know. I don't know. Here's a few statements from Doctrine and Covenants. Now, verse 1, "Verily thus saith the Lord unto my servant Joseph, that inasmuch as you have inquired of my hand to know and understand wherein I, the Lord, justified my servants Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, also Moses, David, and Solomon, my servants, as touching the principle and doctrine of their having many wives and concubines." So they were justified. So that's the first thing here, that God did justify polygamy. But that's not the truth. What he did is he winked at their ignorance. He didn't want them to be doing this. He did not declare them righteous in this thing. This thing was unlawful. They didn't do the right thing in having these many wives. But Joseph Smith says that they did. Verse 3, "Therefore prepare thy heart to receive and obey the instructions which I am about to give unto you. For all those who have this law revealed unto them must obey the same." So if it's revealed, you must obey. You must obey it. And it's interesting to note here that in the footnote, there are 45 cross-references that they give from Doctrine and Covenants in the Bible. So they're really trying to substantiate this. They're really making a big thing out of this. Then it says, verse 4, "For behold, I reveal unto you a new and everlasting covenant. And if ye abide not that covenant, then ye are damned. For no one can reject this covenant and be permitted to enter into my glory." Now, to call it a new covenant is very strange, because that you've got the old covenant, and then you have the new covenant, which is the New Testament revelation of salvation. And then to call this the new covenant, it sounds like this supersedes somehow all the rest. So it's a very peculiar description. And the question really is, how new was it? And did Joseph Smith practice polygamy prior to the revelation? And as far as we can tell, he undoubtedly did. And it's a good possibility. Among the 49 wives in Fawn Brody's list, Smith married 31 of them prior to July 12, 1843, and that is the date on Doctrine and Covenants. These revelations are dated, and this one is dated July 12, 1843, and Fawn Brody has a list of 49 wives, and 31 of them were already married to Joseph Smith before this time. So how can he call this a new covenant? He's already doing it, and have 31 wives, it's got to be going on for quite a while. He was practicing him before he got the revelation. It's quite an amazing situation. And it talks about it being an everlasting covenant. Then it becomes very questionable. How can man ever nullify it? How can man discontinue the practice? How can the Mormon Church really come along and discontinue the practice? I mean, if I was really going to believe Mormonism, and I read this statement, and when you read the statement, then you're well on the way of having the doctrine revealed to you as a Mormon, and the emphasis of the whole thing is, you don't just do it in celestial marriages and go into the temple and marry people in a legal Mormon way, but don't live with them. That's not what it's talking about here. This really means marrying them. And they really are your wife, and that you live with more than one wife. And if you don't do it, the threat is damnation. So if I was a Mormon and I was really going to believe Mormonism, then I'd start looking for more than one wife. And you'd have to say to the federal government, "I'm sorry, but the laws of God are higher than your laws." But they won't do that. They do prohibit the practice. But this is strong language. They're not really living what this is saying. Verses 15 to 17, "Therefore, if a man marry him a wife in the world, and he marry her not by me, nor by my word, and he covenant with her so long as he is in the world, and she with him, their covenant and marriage are not of force when they are dead. And when they are out of the world, therefore, they are not bound by any law when they are out of the world. Therefore, when they are out of the world, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are appointed angels in heaven, which angels are ministering servants to minister for those who are worthy for a far more and exceeding and eternal weight of glory. For these angels did not abide my law, therefore they cannot be enlarged. but remain separate and singly, without exaltation, in their saved condition to all eternity, and from henceforth are not gods, but are angels of God forever and ever. So he's saying, he's not talking about people who didn't get married, who didn't enter into polygamy, but for some reason they would not enter into the covenant of eternal marriage. They wouldn't get married in the temple for the celestial sealing, so that it, for an eternal way. And those who won't do that, they're not damned, but they're just angels. So those ones are angels. They're not able to become gods. In order to become gods, you've got to enter into celestial marriage. And really, according to this, you've got to be married to more than one woman, and you should really be living with that, with those, whatever, 2, 3, 4, 50, 487, whatever it might be. So that's part of polygamy. We'll continue with this next time. Papers, go right ahead.
I made a terrible error.